This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane Dorian has devastated parts of the Bahamas. Bahamian armed forces and other rescue workers are searching for the missing in Abaco, which bore the brunt of the Category 5 storm, and a flotilla of boats and planes are ferrying survivors off the worst-hit parts of the island chain. Joining us for more are Orlando Sentinel reporter Chibeli Herrera, who went to the Bahamas on a cruise ship that was also taking supplies for the stricken islands. Thank you so much for being here, Chibeli.
Thank you.
I'm also joined by Paul Brinkman. He's a reporter with United Press International. He rode along with a group of volunteers who shipped supplies over on a fishing boat. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Matthew.
Chibeli, I want to start with you. This was a cruise ship that essentially made a few adjustments to carry out some humanitarian aid en route, right? What exactly was the purpose of the trip?
Yeah, so Royal Caribbean, pretty quickly after the storm hit, said they were going to start sending supplies with their ships that were already scheduled to travel to the area of the Bahamas over the weekend. So they started sending ships over, and other cruise lines are doing the same, Norwegian and Carnival as well. But Royal went first, and so we quickly tried to get on one of the ships because we wanted to see what the relief efforts were looking like. And essentially, they, you know, have their crew prepare about 10,000 meals per ship overnight. And these are ships that are going to Nassau, but right before that stop, they kind of divert a little and go and stop in Freeport, which was an area that was devastated by the storm. And so they offload those meals there. And on our trip, they also brought on 261 evacuees from the island and then took them over to Nassau later that day.
So, Chibeli, is it simply a sense of they have the food on board, they offload it, and then it's up to the relief workers who are actually on the island to disperse it? Or does the folks on the ship, the staff, kind of stick around and help hand it out? What happens there?
Yeah, so in our case, because we were leaving out of Port Canaveral, Royal Caribbean sent some truckloads of their food from their warehouse in Miami, and that was the food that was prepared on board. It was cooked by you know, the chefs on board and prepared by the crew. But once we got to Freeport in the morning, they were taken off trolleys, and then we had local folks come in with trucks. I mean, basically whatever vehicle they could find, they were bringing it in. It was kind of madness there in the morning, and trying to get all of those box loads of food. And so they were going to be the ones that were distributing them. We understand through NEMA, which is sort of like the Bahamian equivalent of FEMA. And they were going to be distributing a lot of that to local churches and other organizations where they knew there was the most need.
Give us a sense of what you saw when the ship pulled up in Freeport. Like, what did it look like?
Yeah, so it was very, very dark. You could tell there was no electricity or power anywhere on the island. And what struck me the most was in all of that darkness, you know, you saw sort of the little blinking lights of cars that were already lining up. We got there very early in the morning, I think maybe 4:30, 5 in the morning. And all of the cars were lining up to try to evacuate. So that was pretty sort of difficult to see all of the evacuees streaming into the ship. And the majority of them were children, because one of the major groups evacuated on this voyage was an orphanage in Freeport. About 40 kids came on the ship with us. And so that was pretty difficult to see, as well as when we got to Nassau, a lot of them didn't know where they were going. So the orphanage in Nassau picked up the kids, but some of the other groups, they were just sort of unsure what was going next, and they didn't have anything with them, just the shirts on their backs, and were trying to just get out.
And did you talk to some of the folks who were being picked up and taken to Nassau?
Yes, yes. We spoke to one family who owns vacation villas that were destroyed in the storm, or not completely destroyed, but they were definitely damaged in the storm. And they were leaving, trying to, they weren't sure where they were going to go next, maybe Florida, because it was interesting. They said, you know, there's no, we can't rebuild our own business here. So they were thinking of going to Home Depot here in Florida to pick up supplies and take them back to rebuild their business. And some of their staff that lost their homes, they had given them some of the villas that had survived the storm a little better to live in the meantime. So a lot of uncertainty, a lot of people who just were just really trying to get out without really much of a plan of where to go next.
Right. Yeah, I mean, some of the images that we saw as the storm was coming in, and then since, it does look like utter devastation. I'm sure that a lot of folks are still trying to wrap their heads around the scope of what happened.
Yeah. And in particular, there was one. There was only one Bahamian crew member on the ship that we were on, and she was trying to reconnect with her sister who lives in Freeport. And we were able to speak to her sister in the port when they were able to reunite for the first time after the storm. And her sister was saying, you know, some homes around me, she was lucky her home was okay, but around me, there's only one wall left standing. There were rumors that sharks had washed in the water with a storm. And she just, you know, a lot of them kept repeating the fact that they were really sort of shocked by the fact that the storm really sat on top of them for such a long period of time. They were just praying and praying that it would move on so that they could begin the recovery.
Mm-hmm. Paul Brinkman, you went with a group on a fishing boat, so a slightly different mission in a sense. Just tell me about how that came about.
Yeah, very different mission. So there were a group of fishermen in South Florida who made regular trips to the Bahamas throughout their life, and they loved the Bahamas, and it had been a key part of really, what they told me was that it was a big part of their family life, that they would go on family vacations there and that they had all these great memories in the Bahamas. And when they realized what the devastation was and what the impact on people that they knew there was going to be, they immediately started to think about how they could help. And of course, it is a little controversial because not everyone with a fishing boat can go over there. I was fortunate enough to connect with a group of fishermen that included like special forces and federal agents who happened to own fishing boats. So very qualified, connected people who really knew what they were doing and had were able to communicate with the Coast Guard and the Bahamian government through an organization in Miami, of the Bahamas, National Association of the Bahamas in Miami. And so they were able to put together about 30 boats and all very, you know, capable boats, powerful engines that could move fast. And they watched the weather predictions. So they were all loaded down with supplies. We left at dawn from Hillsborough Inlet, and we met some people from West Palm Beach, just offshore of the island. We went to the West End community of Grand Bahama Island, which was actually like the only part of the island that did not get the worst of the hurricane.
Right, because from what we've heard, there was pretty bad flooding. Like, a lot of the island was essentially underwater.
Yes, and so West End did get storm surge, and that was evident because storm surge is seawater, and the grass and the trees and the landscaping cannot tolerate seawater. And so everything was pretty much dead or dying and rotting, and all of the septic tanks in the area had overflowed during the storm surge. So, it was a really awful smell in parts of that area.
So they're kind of looking at it's a disaster on many levels. It's not just the impact of the storm, it's also the after effects, the environmental kind of catastrophe unfolding.
Very much so. West End includes Old Bahama Bay, which is a large resort and marina. And during Matthew also clobbered Grand Bahama. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was nothing like the destruction that this brought on the eastern and central parts of the island. The West End of Grand Bahama actually escaped the worst of Dorian. It did not really escape the worst of Matthew, but it had served as a focal point for recovery mm-hmm. from Matthew.
So in this case, do you have a lot of folks from elsewhere in the Bahamas who are kind of gravitating there because it's the only place they can go?
To the extent that they could get there, and to the extent that the mission, the fishermen were actually well organized and connected. So if people on Grand Bahama Island had a connection through churches and the Bahamas ministry, then they could come in. But the resort was actually turning away people that had no, that just showed up and didn't have a connection because certain items were dedicated. You know, they were brought over by people who wanted a certain church to have a generator. And probably those churches and organizations were, actually serving the people. There was a lot of concerns about hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that, there were concerns about it. I wasn't able to investigate how legitimate those concerns were, but many people said that during Matthew, there were certain individuals that managed to scoop up a whole lot of supplies and hoard them. And so they were on guard against that. The scene outside the gate of the resort was really desperate and kind of appalling. There were like 40 or 50 cars in line that wanted to get into the resort to get supplies, and they were turning them away. There were Bahamas police there from the west end of Grand Bahama, and there were people that had been waiting out there for hours and hours. So, yeah, it was...
Do you get the sense that either the government of the Bahamas or others are going to be able to help those folks who are just essentially camped there waiting for some help?
Well, a common theme from people I talked to, and this was an extremely intense and fairly short visit for me. The fishermen arrived around 10 a.m. and we left by 11:30. So I was actually able to get off the boat and talk to a whole lot of people during that time. Many of them told me that the government was doing nothing and that they were very disappointed in that. And they were incredibly grateful for a private effort that was bringing in relief and supplies. As I said, that was even in itself controversial because some of the boat captains told me that there was a possibility of cars or cargo containers that had been washed into the ocean that might be floating that we wouldn't see until the last minute.
Right, so some concerns about navigation.
Yeah, and so they took risks going over there. There was a Coast Guard cutter stationed just off of West End. I don't know whether that was something that they would have done anyway, or if they were doing it particularly because they knew that a large number of boats from the U.S. were coming at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But it did give the boaters that I was with some confidence that, that they could navigate through there and get to the port.
Mm-hmm. Tribelli, if I could come back to you for a moment, talking about what the cruise industry is doing, not just Royal Caribbean, the ship that you were on, but also others. Obviously, the Bahamas is a port of call for the cruise industry, so, it's in their interest to see them kind of get back on their feet. And we have been reading about concerns from Bahamians that, if the tourism industry shuts down, that's going to make it even harder for them to recover. Just kind of give us a sense of the thinking there from the cruise industry and also folks that you've talked to in the Bahamas about, what the challenges going forward.
Yeah, so, obviously the Bahamas is a huge, huge destination for the cruise lines. For Royal Caribbean, for example, it was the very first port that they ever went to. So they're invested in the area. They're in constant communication with, tourism officials on the ground, and it's also in their best in their benefit to be able to continue to sail there and get their islands back in shape. Almost every cruise line has a private island in the Bahamas. A lot of them were very close to where the storm hit. Royal Caribbean's, for example, we visited theirs on Sunday, and they told us that they brought almost 500 people in over the course of 2 to 3 days, in which they cleaned up the entire island. And again, they didn't have structural damage, but they had some sand and trees that were down so that they could open as quickly as possible, get their cruisers back in those islands.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of, all of this is part of the larger tourism industry, which, for the Bahamas and this is the case for many islands in the Caribbean, that's their number one industry. It's over 50% of their GDP. And so they rely very, very, very heavily on people visiting. And so the issue that they have now is, it's a bit of a perception issue, and it's happened, I think after almost every storm, this kind of continues to come up, and it's, people not being aware that only two islands in a 700-island archipelago were hit,
mm-hmm.
Grand Bahama and Abaco. But Nassau is fine. Lutra is fine. Exuma is fine. Bimini, you know, so they're really trying to get the message out quite quickly that, you know, the Bahamas is still open. You can still come and visit. And, you know, it's only these two islands that were really severely impacted. Otherwise, you'll have basically the same experience if you come back. And it's really spoke to the Minister of Tourism, and he was just saying, you know, this is crucial for us, because that money that comes in is going to help us rebuild the northern Bahamas where the storm hit. And mm-hmm. if people are reluctant to come back, you know, that's going to impact us long term.
And you also reported on some of the folks who are just there for a cruise, right? It must be a bit of a surreal experience, you know, taking your cruise and also knowing that there's some relief effort ongoing as part of that cruise, and some of the folks they're serving are pretty desperate.
Yeah, it was, for us at least, it was a really odd experience. You know, we were in the dining room the first night as they were prepping all of the meals, and right outside you could hear the music and people dancing, having a good old time. You know, these people booked their cruises long before the hurricane was ever scheduled to go anywhere. And so they were just trying to make the best out of the vacation that they already had planned. But it was very odd to sort of oscillate between those two things. You know, when we were on the dock in the morning, and then you go back in the ship and people are in the pool with their pina coladas and their margaritas and taking shots, and they're having a good old time. We spoke to some of the cruisers, and, you know, they all, you know, across the board, everybody's saying, you know, we're so glad that they're doing this. This really makes us feel really good about traveling with this company. And we had a pair of cruisers the morning we got to Freeport who were, I caught up with them sort of looking over the rail there, watching the efforts. And they were just saying, we actually volunteered to try to help. But, you know, Royal Caribbean was just only letting its crew do that because they had sort of a system already in place. But some people did want to help as well. So, yeah, it was interesting to have both of those things going on at the same time.
I would say that it was also surreal on our trip. I was on most of the boats that were in our flotilla were luxury fishing boats or very high end. I was on a triple decker luxury fishing boat that, and the weather was absolutely beautiful. And, you know, we left at dawn from Hillsborough Inlet Lighthouse area, and it was gorgeous, and people were really enjoying that. But, you know, the reality of what we were going into, you know, didn't escape us. So, mm-hmm. and then when we got there, it was a very desperate scene.
The folks that you sailed with, Paul, are they planning more of these missions?
Yeah, they are. They have the capability, and as I said, they have the connections to do it right. So I would certainly not recommend that, you know, that you try this at home for people who are not set up or connected or have the knowledge of navigation around the Bahamas. If you've never been there before, it would not be a time for you to try to go there. But for these people, they are planning to go to Freeport next, because Freeport is, you know, opening up more now. And then they were planning to also go to Nassau, which, although Nassau was spared the worst, they are now overwhelmed by refugees, because apparently the entire island of Grand Abaco is being evacuated, except for maybe one community, Cooperstown, I think Cooperstown, mm-hmm. That, you know, there are concerns about disease spreading there. And so they are apparently mandatory evacuations from Abaco. And there are large refugee communities being set up in Nassau. And the latest reporting that I've seen from other national media, because I haven't been there, is that Nassau is now, you know, pretty much overwhelmed by that.
Well, Paul Brinkman is a reporter with UPI. He rode along with a group of volunteers who shipped supplies over to the Bahamas on a flotilla of fishing boats. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
Also joined by Chabali Herrera. She's a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. She went to the Bahamas on a Royal Caribbean cruise ship that was taking supplies for the stricken islands. Thank you as well, Chabali.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, we'll talk with political scientist Michael Gunter about polarized politics and a warming climate. That's when we return. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Political scientist Michael Gunter says powerful hurricanes like Dorian reinforce the need to confront the reality of climate change before it's too late. Gunter says the solution is twofold, changing the way we live to slow climate change and adapting to a warmer planet. Gunter is an author and speaker on global environmental affairs and a professor and international relations director at Rollins College. 2 years ago, he published an op-ed in USA Today, Confront Climate Change or Count on Even Crueler Hurricanes and Septembers. From the Education Desk this week, a conversation about teaching the politics of climate change. Michael Gunter, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So back in 2017, you were writing about that hurricane season, the one that gave us Irene and Maria, among others, but you could have been writing about this summer. Does your op-ed need a footnote? Has your thinking changed at all since 2017?
No, it hasn't. I think that no one weather event, as the climate scientists say, can be attributed to climate change, but the likelihood for stronger and stronger weather events like Hurricane Dorian are much more likely. And it's a simple scientific fact of the warming temperatures and the warming waters. And we saw that as quickly as Hurricane Dorian strengthened just recently.
So your specialty is international relations, political scientists. What's the kind of Venn diagram that shows the political science and climate science meshing together? Like, what's the sort of space you're working in?
Right. You know, over the last 20, 25 years, the science on climate change has gotten stronger and stronger in terms of our understanding of what it means, how often we're going to have to deal with these kinds of weather events, what the different types of climate change threats are. You know, in many ways, we in Florida are at ground zero. There's some other states in the U.S. and certainly other countries that would lay claim to be ground zero for climate change. But we have sea level rise. We have stronger hurricanes to deal with. I think that even as that science has gotten stronger, though, in the United States, the political ideological divide has widened. And yes, there are very real political debates to have about the policies that we should implement, conservative and liberal approaches there, and those are worthy. However, the science of climate changing, that should not be up for political discussion. And unfortunately, the divide there in terms of partisan persuasion and, more accurately, ideological perspective, that has grown.
So do you think it is possible to separate out the politics from the science when it comes to studying the climate and the impact of climate change and looking at the politics of it all?
A short answer would be no, but a longer answer would be yes. I mean, politics is in everything we do, right? I just was making a joke yesterday in my intro international relations class about it's in every social relationship we have. Familiar, got to talk about my beautiful mother-in-law. I love my mother-in-law. But politics isn't everything. So climate scientists deal with their fellow climate scientists in politics. That said, I would argue that we're talking about basic scientific relationships. As temperatures warm, there's more water vapor in the air, and the oceans are soaking up a big chunk. There was a study last January that just showed that over 90% of warming is being absorbed by the ocean waters. So we're going to have more fuel to storms like Hurricane Dorian available. Mm-hmm. And, that's just a scientific fact. That's not something that you debate. You debate about how you react to that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to Michael Gunter, he's a political scientist teaching at Rollins College. Michael, let me sort of take that question I asked you before and turn it on its head a little bit. Does politics get in the way of finding solutions to problems posed by a warming planet?
It does. It does. But it's at the same time, paradoxically, it's the problem and it's the solution. And I think, I'm at Rollins College, and one of our most famous alumni is Mr. Rogers. And I think, Mr. Rogers taught us a lesson years ago that's applicable here, and it's applicable in some other very hot-button, controversial issues in the United States today, like gun control. And that is that we have to live together. And to think of opponents on particular issues as the enemy and the opposition is problematic. We all are in the same neighborhood as Mr. Rogers has, and you have learned to need to treat people with respect and find ways that you can come to agreement when there's a common problem that you face. And so what I've been exploring with the topic of climate change is how do we open people's eyes to that? And I think that one way to do that is for people to see for themselves the impacts of what's been developing over the last several decades. You know, climate change came to the American public's consciousness way back in the late 80s, 1980s, in some famous Senate hearings. We weren't calling it climate change then. We were calling it global warming. But that climate scientists have emphasized this name shift because they think global warming is a little bit of a misnomer. It distracts from all the other aspects involved in climate change to just focus on temperature, even though the temperature is the driving force. So even as we were aware of this in 1988, very little has been done at the national level. We do have examples at local and even at some state levels. And I think that's where the real hope immediate hope is that there will continue to be a sort of a grassroots municipal state governments will employ initiatives that will basically show the way for national government to follow.
Are you seeing that in Florida?
I am. We are the Sunshine State after all. Mm-hmm. It is frustrating to know that even as we are the Sunshine State, I think we're still number 10 in terms of solar output productivity. Mm-hmm.
There are co-ops locally that are trying to change the equation there.
Exactly. There's the Central Florida co-op that has really brought in several hundred families into the solar production that probably many of them, myself included, would not have if it hadn't been for that co-op. And, you know, Orlando itself, under Mayor Dyer and his sustainability director, Chris Castro, have been out at the forefront on this, and we're trying to catch up.
Mm-hmm. Just coming back to the question of the politics of this all, I mean, what do you tell people who are skeptical of the science, and if you are trying to sort of take the Mr. Rogers approach and bring people into the conversation, how do you do that? If you look online, you know, you go on some Facebook threads, for example, you're going to see a lot of people sort of shouting at each other online. How do you get past that?
Yeah, that's tough. And because we've really siloed our political discussion with social media and online access. I think it's got to be face to face and in person, and you know you don't have to. I've written about high profile international destinations. You don't have to travel far to go see this. Here in our state, you can go to St. Augustine, you can go to Miami Beach, you can go pretty much anywhere along the coast and see the day to day evidence of climate change. You don't have to be in a storm situation. You know, they used to call it nuisance day flooding. Now they call it sunny day flooding, right? Mm-hmm. They're continually having troubles with sea level rise, particularly during king tides, during the largest tides of the year. You know, Miami Beach spent, I think it's over $500 million now on a system of pumping stations and literally raising the roads so that they can deal with sea level rise. And that's expected to take them about to 2050, and then they'll have to start over. So I think it's about, you know, as one emerging area for years now in higher ed has been the emphasis on experiential education. You know, mm-hmm. we don't just lecture to our students. We don't just have them read on their own and then we highlight what they were reading. We actually take them to the places that we're reading about and let them see for themselves. And it soaks in more and they have deeper questions, more specific practical questions.
So you take your students to Miami Beach?
I have not gone to Miami Beach, maybe down the road. Mm-hmm. But I did just get to do a trip with a colleague in the German, in the modern language department. She specializes in German overseas. And we got to see a little bit tied into climate change on a trip to Namibia. Yeah, Miami Beach is a good suggestion. I'll see if the administrators will buy that.
Let me ask you a little bit about the sort of the, how you go about teaching it, too. And I'm wondering how important it is to kind of instill a sense of political engagement. I'm guessing your students are already politically engaged because they're taking the course, right? But is it important to, if you're thinking about experiential education, go to city hall meetings and sort of see, here's how policy gets made at the local level?
Yeah, I think it is. You want to be careful not to weight that too much. You don't want to chase them away too soon. Let me give you an example of a course I did last spring. It was a course on climate change politics. And thanks to people like Meredith Hine and Mickey Meyer on campus, I was able to make that a community engagement course where we worked directly with a lady named Amanda Day at a bike walk Central Florida. And our students would help go to various crosswalks around basically Orange and also Osceola County and collect data on how often cars were violating the crosswalk regulations in terms of a pedestrian being in there. The students also went to some meetings. These were these weren't council meetings, but they were I think it was a monthly safety traffic meeting where they presented some of the data that they had collected, and then they also presented for the board of Bike Walk Central Florida. So the kids were out there understanding, and the purpose of all this was to see ways in which our community has and can continue to improve upon the carbon footprint to help encourage biking and walking and less driving. We did some other trips where we went down to the city of Kissimmee and learned about the impact of SunRail there and the way development has grown around their station. So I think, yes, long-winded route to your question, if we can get not just college students but anyone out there to see ways in which negative impacts are happening, but also ways in which, and we don't want this to be always a Chicken Little kind of, you know, traditional environmentalist alarm. The positive side of the story, I think, is a very important piece to tell as well.
Well, Michael Gunter is an author, a speaker on global environmental affairs, and professor and international relations director at Rollins College. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Up next, musician and event curator Jared Sylvia has a new record label. We'll talk to Sylvia about why the label's first album was released on cassette. That's after the break. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Musician and event curator Jared Sylvia has a new record label, Circuit Church. The song you're listening to, Here Now, is from Modal Plains' album, Terra Null. It's the first album released on the Circuit Church label. Jared Sylvia, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So you've got a new record label.
Yeah.
And your focus is cassettes.
Yes.
Tell me about this record label.
Well, so the record label is called Circuit Church. It comes out of a group of synthesizer enthusiasts that has been doing events here in Orlando for a couple of years. And the record label's focus, like you said, is cassette tapes. We also release digitally alongside the cassette tapes.
Circuit Church sounds like there's something kind of reverential about it. Is this how you feel about electronic music?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the whole idea about reverence and electronic music and also the cassette tapes, it all kind of flows together. When I think about a cassette, the experience of listening to a cassette is so linear. It takes us back to a different time in some cases. But I mean, it's very common for, you know, sort of startup labels now to release cassettes because they're considerably cheaper than vinyl records to produce. But yeah, it's a linear listening experience. We're sort of trusting ourselves to the artist and, you know, listening to what they wanted to present on the side of a cassette all at once. So yeah, that's kind of part of the mindfulness or reverential aspect of the name, yeah.
But don't you remember putting a cassette in and then trying to find the right place in the album? I mean, isn't that sort of part of the whole experience, like going back and forwards? and trying to find the place where you really want to listen from?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we think about music that way now. I'll click to the track I want to listen to, or I'll load the track I want to listen to on Spotify, or I'll load the playlist I want to listen to. But what often happens when we do that is it's like single serving music. And mm-hmm. and with things like Spotify, I wonder if I'm even listening to the music when I put on a Spotify playlist and just have it randomly playing.
So you're saying you want to force the listener to actually sit down and pay attention, because it's going to be too much work for them to kind of hit the fast forward, the rewind button.
Yeah. Well, I mean, force is a strong word, but I want them to come to it with that, you know, that trust. You know, it's like a trusting relationship. Yeah.
What about sound quality then? Because isn't that one of the drawbacks of the cassette, is it's a little less durable of a medium? Like if you have a cassette and you love it and you play that album so many times, you leave it in your car and it gets really hot, it's going to get that kind of wobble on it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of those things about how we've cared for our music in the past, like leaving a box of tapes in the car. And yeah, they would get pretty gnarly after a while. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's interesting is modern cassettes, I mean, they have improved the technology considerably.
Really?
And yeah. And so, you know, you have a better magnetic layout on the actual tape itself. And it's pretty, I mean, the medium has fundamentally not changed that much. But if you take care of them, they sound pretty nice. But that's part of the reason we're releasing them digitally mm-hmm. as well. So it's like you buy the tape and you have the object of the tape for a time, but then you have the music persistently in a digital format. And another thing we're doing is we're actually recording the cassette tape in and offering it as part of the digital download. So you have a recording of how the tape sound on day one, you know, sounded on day one, yeah.
Is there kind of a connection then between the style of music, you know, electronic music? Like, does it seem like it's of an era, like the 80s or 90s? Is that sort of why it's a good mix or a good match for cassettes?
That's right on point. Yeah. I mean, you know, we think of electronic music, and especially music that's very synthesizer focused, as being kind of retro in some ways. But what's common between the era of the 80s, when, you know, the cassette was one of the more standard release formats, mm-hmm. and now is, you know, the electronic instruments sound really, really good on an analog medium. And especially now that, you know, even though we're producing electronic music with old analog synthesizers still, they're going into a digital recording system, which is just a matter of practicality. So putting it back to cassette tape, it's never going to quite get it back to how it sounded in the room at the moment, but it does inject just a little bit of that kind of like difference in saturation. And there's just all kinds of really interesting things that happen when you listen to the digital version, which is straight off of the computer masters, mm-hmm. versus the tape version.
So you're saying you like that element of uncertainty about it?
Yeah, it's really exciting. I mean, when we get the tapes back, we have no idea what we're going to hear compared to the masters that we sent out. I mean, it's going to be close, but it's like, where are things going to start to kind of like blur together, and you know, kind of like, is it going to be really separated, is it going to really start to kind of like crunch around in the middle? You know, it's very exciting. Yeah.
So you're also the executive producer of the album Terra Null by Modal Plane.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me about this partnership. How did you come in contact with this artist, and what was the process like of making that album?
Yeah, so Modal Plane is a local artist. He's in here in Orlando. He's from Orlando, actually. And he has just an incredible, capability as a synthesist and composer. He was one of the people that was part of a group of us that kind of got together in 2016 at the behest of the local visual artist Synthestruct, Ginger Lee. Knew all these people that were into synthesizers and just kind of said, you should all get together. And we did, and we just started kind of making plans to do interesting things in town. But when we started talking about doing a record label in 2018, he kind of came to mind, because he's a very he just puts music together so quickly and constantly, and it just felt like a really obvious match for our first release. Mm-hmm. So the process of doing it was really, I would check in with him every once in a while as he was writing the initial tracks. And, you know, he'd send me things. And at first, we actually had this really big selection of music. It was something like, you know, over a little over an hour of actual music. And I was like, I don't know if we can do all this in like, you know, one cassette tape. And so we ended up kind of like calling it back to a, you know, about 40 minutes, like 20 minutes aside or so, about 21 minutes. And, and you know, of just the parts that kind of described this world, Terra Null. And it's very much a piece about a place without a specific, you know, there's no real like narration or obvious like, but it's very sensory. So finding that sensory life of the album was a very big important part of the process. And, you know, going through the mastering and all the things that you typically do with an album, you know, trying to find the right version that would be the release. And
right.
Yeah. So that was kind of what my role was in this process, which was very minimal compared to his role.
what does Terra Null mean?
Well, Terra Null is a place. I mean, it's in the artist's mind and Will's mind, Will Modelplane. You know, it's a planet with a very interesting topography that, as far as I can tell, looks a lot like glitching videotapes, mountains and oceans and just lots of static.
Place you'd want to live?
I don't know if I'd want to live there, but I certainly wouldn't mind being an explorer. Yeah, but but part of the release, we also had video artists creating pieces that correspond with certain tracks, and they, I think, are starting to explore some of what the texture of the place is like, too.
So do you feel like, is there space on your label for maybe more upbeat kind of dance club genre of electronic music, or are you firmly in the sort of lo-fi ambient exploratory mode of things?
Well, I really do think there is room for the dancey and more upbeat things. I mean, that's the kind of music I make, and I think that's ultimately, hopefully, I could put one of my own things out on there someday. But maybe when I finish something and stop producing other people's things. But yeah, I mean, the only guiding theme for this is that it's electronic, but also that it's very personal. And that, to me, it is I keep thinking about this idea of like, well, what if a DJ wants to play this? Should we put out a record so that we can give it to DJs that like to spin vinyl? Or should we put it out on, you know, one of like the DJ specific release mediums like Beatport or something? And I keep coming back to this idea is like, no, this is very personal music. This is music for one person or a few people to listen to. It doesn't feel like it will appeal to, you know, that kind of like, you know, club environment, you know, where it's back to that thing that I worry about just sort of like background music.
Right. And you run an experimental electronic music series at the Nook. It's on Robinson. You do that every month?
Yeah, monthly. And it's also called Circuit Church. Up until recently, it was called Moloko Plus, but we just kind of changed the name to Circuit Church when we launched the label. But yeah, it's also very similar. Yeah.
And it's not a very big space, right?
No, not at all. It's a wonderfully compact space. That's how I like to think about it.
Okay. So, what's the scene like then? Do you find there's a line out the door, or are you really kind of just appealing to a small group of people who are really, really into this kind of music?
Yeah. I think it's somewhere in between. I mean, we definitely have had nights where it's really packed in there, and you know, it always depends on the time of the year and everything, but yeah, I mean, the part about it appealing to a group of people that are into it, that's definitely true. I mean, a lot of the people that come out to the events are electronic musicians themselves, and they're a lot of people come out and they're like, you know, I'm into synthesizers, I'm into you know, modular synths. I didn't know anyone else in town was doing this. It's just exciting to see that there's a scene for this. And you know, there's a great electronic music scene here in town, and that goes from anything from like the club, you know, more like dance club type music, to like we've got this phenomenal, very kind of like gothy and dark wave electronic scene too. And I think we're just kind of a newer element, you know, where we're bringing out the modular synths and doing that kind of thing, and hitting the experimental vibes. So
we're talking to Jared Sylvia. He's a musician and event curator in Orlando. Jared, just coming back to the cassette, and I'm wondering about this first album too. What was the run on that? Like, how many did you produce?
Yeah, so we're doing very limited runs on the physical version. It's 100 tapes only.
Did you sell them all?
Not yet, but there are still some. And but you know, we did it that way because this is it's very much like an art object. You know, we think of it as, you know, it's this thing that has a very specific design and some kind of quirky elements to it. You know, like the art on the album is very specific and designed by the artist and things like that. So yeah, we wanted it to be something that people would maybe, like, you know, get and think about the tape and sort of treasure. I don't know, maybe treasure. That's what I like to think they would treasure it.
But, right.
But yeah, maybe I didn't answer your question very well. But
what about the art then? Because you think about LPs, you know, there's definitely a format for LP cover art, right? Like, that's a kind of a genre of art in and of itself. Cassettes, though, you're working with a pretty small thing. Like, you know, when I think of cassettes that I would buy, that they would have like this long sort of folding thing that would fold out and out like an accordion. I mean, is that a good way to like, is there a form of art that fits well with that medium?
You know, yeah, it's funny to think about that, because when we were designing the cover, we kept it to just the basic, they call it a J card, you know, but it's just
right.
the single fold.
'Cause it's got the little fold.
Exactly, yeah. where the tape kind of sits in there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were thinking, like, how does a modern tape look? Or should we embrace the kind of like retro vibe and make it look like a tape might have, you know, in a previous era? And we kind of decided to go with that. Mm-hmm. And our big inspiration was like 1960s and 70s science fiction novel covers, where it's, you know, sort of this bold color and like, you know, an image and then all the text beneath it. But the artist was very specific about wanting things on the tape, like the word stereo with like some kind of indication of like headphones or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we were able to kind of like play with some of these retro visual elements, like the back of a cassette tape packaging is often very crowded with information. So
sure,
we had to
yeah.
kind of think of how to crowd it right to make it kind of have that same feeling. But then on the inside, there's nothing. I mean, there's a picture, but there's no text. So it's like where we probably should have put all the text, we just kind of left it blank. I don't know if that's a statement, but it was kind of a fun thing to, I don't know, kind of waste space in a way, but not really waste it, just kind of like, it's a gazing space, I guess, you know, where the tape just nestles in.
And there are only 100 of those pieces of art.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's a limited run, you know, almost like a print or something. I should have numbered them. Mm-hmm. That would have been smart. Oh, well.
Yeah.
Too
late
now.
Do you have any other artists lined up?
Yeah, actually, the next thing we're doing is we're actually going to release a VHS tape.
VHS?
Yeah.
Okay.
A VHS tape. We should have done Betamax. No, it's going to be VHS. And it's going to be also a modal plane and an artist he often collaborates with in Chicago, Sarah Goodman. She's a video artist and a writer, and they've been working on this really exciting project, and it's going to be a combination of music, writing, and incredibly interesting experimental video by Sarah and other video artists. So we're really excited about that. Hopefully we'll have that out by, you know, early next year.
How many copies of that do you envisage?
It's going to be pretty limited, probably no more than 50 or 60. Yeah, it's going to be pretty small, but maybe more. We haven't decided yet.
There is a connection between electronic musicians and, you know, when they do their live performances, there's often visual elements going on though, right? So that seems to go pretty well together.
Absolutely. I mean, part of like how our interaction, Modal Plane Will and I, our interaction has been, you know, for the early events that we were putting together, he was often creating live visuals using, you know, an experimental video rig that he has kind of put together. So he's also very interesting in that way. And actually, he did one of the videos for his own album, which is really, really cool. And I'm excited about it.
There's a listening party and performance at Park Avenue CDs coming up. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, Park Ave, they're a great place, you know, because they sell cassette tapes first off. And when we were kind of thinking about where we wanted to do a listening party, it really had to be a store that had not just old cassettes, but like current cassettes. And they definitely have curated a nice collection. So, yeah, we're doing the listening party there on Friday the 13th, this coming Friday. And it's going to be both, we're going to listen to the tape while people are milling about and hanging out. And we're also going to have an in-store performance by Modal Plane. Mm-hmm. He'll be out there with the modular synth and do, you know, a set. And there'll be tapes for sale and we'll be hanging out and saying hello.
Is there going to be some visuals going on there as well?
Yeah, I think that's part of the plan. Yeah, so it'll be kind of a full experience. We'll bring it all together.
Well, Jared Sylvia, musician and event curator and founder, I guess, of Circuit Church record label, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew. It's very nice to see you as usual.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gonda. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.